Thank you, David. Of course, as you know so well, there are two weak links in the transition from discovery in universities and the wider economy. The first is the so-called valley of death between academia and viable startups, and the second stems from the lack of venture capital in the UK, which leads to premature sellouts to the US. I'm going to talk mainly about the academic end of this chain, but stimulated by a last contribution, I'd like to spend 2 minutes at the end on my favoured grand challenge, which is indeed dealing with energy and the environment. We're used to the idea that research is concentrated in universities. This is a system which has prevailed in the US and the UK, but it doesn't prevail everywhere. Although the research university was invented by Humboldt in Germany, most of that nation's best researchers are now in Max Planck institutes. And in France, they're civil servants in CNRS institutions. So the kind of academic career that mixes teaching and research is really a sort of Anglo-Saxon model, although it's now been widely adopted in the Far East. Research universities benefit the economy partly through direct knowledge transfer to industry. And even though the follow through may be channeled towards a few priority challenges, academia should surely collectively cover the whole map of learning. That's for two reasons. First, to optimize teaching, because a very important output of the universities is, of course, good students. But second, to maintain a watching brief over the whole world's research so as to seize on a new idea and run with it. UK startups need not be based on ideas that germinate here. We have more than our share of clever ideas in the world, but still 90%+ come from elsewhere. You ought to be in touch with them. And of course, we can't confidently predict how or when or whether a specific academic research project will pay off. Still less when its applications will offer socio-economic benefit. But successes are favored by a nurturing environment. And let me quote a former Royal Society president, Aaron Klug, I quote, "The major insights in science come from people who have the patience to develop an intimate understanding of a problem, who have the space and the freedom to take professional risks, and who know how to make creative use of the surprises that they encounter when they do so. These are the people who make the enduring difference. These are the people whom we must nurture wherever we find them." And it's true that confidence and high morale are what drive creativity, innovation, and risk-taking. That's true in science, but in the arts and in entrepreneurial activity too. And researchers themselves have the best expertise and the strongest motive for judging what topics hold promise. Their careers depend on making good choices. And the difference in payoff between the very best research and the merely good is by any measure thousands of percent. So what's most crucial in giving taxpayers enhanced value for money isn't the few percent of savings that might be made by improving efficiency in the office management sense. It's maximizing the chance of the big breakthroughs by attracting top talent, backing the judgment of those with the best credentials, and supporting them appropriately. And they're the people who research universities must attract and nurture. A perennial tension in funding bodies is between the support of people and the support of specific projects. The latter option is administratively tidier and allows the funder to demand quarterly reports of progress and keep track of steps towards a declared target. And it's sadly becoming more dominant. But history shows that it's often the freewheeling inquiry which leads to the biggest advances. And in lively research groups, it's exhilarating when coffee time conversations toss out new ideas and debate the latest discoveries. And I'm lucky to have worked in one of them. But even in this kind of privileged environment, my younger colleagues seem ever more preoccupied with grant cuts, proposal writing, job security, and such like. Prospects of breakthroughs will plummet if such concerns prey unduly on the minds of even the best young researchers. When there was an article on this theme in Research Fortnight, the editor gave it the title, "Why I'm Glad I'm Not a Young Academic." And that was not my title, but that is true. it's not just in the UK, but in the EU and the US that bodies allocate public funding based on ever more detailed performance indicators to quantify the output. This has the best of intentions, but it can impede the best professional practice. There's a danger that a focus on what can be measured and can feature in lead tables may distort policy to the detriment of longer term benefits. And because of these pressures, universities risk becoming less propitious environments for research projects that demand intense and sustained effort. Indeed, one reason why the UK has developed special strength in biomedical sciences stems from the existence of laboratories allowing full-time, long-term research that is getting harder and harder to do in universities. The LMB and the CRIC and John Innes and Rothamsted, for instance, may allow better environment. There's a downside, of course, as they reduce talented researchers from contact with students. And of course, in biomedical areas, UK government funding is massively supplemented by the Wellcome Trust, cancer charities, etc., and physical sciences aren't so lucky. But if a science superpower is to be more than just a vacuous phrase, we've surely got to ensure two things. We've got to ensure that academia attracts a share of young people with flexible talent who want to achieve something distinctive in their 30s, and that's harder. And the US is having the same problems as us in this respect. We risk academia becoming a repository for the kind of nerds who couldn't do anything else. And we need to promote percolation between the sectors. Academia is far too rigid in its promotion criteria and allowing people to enter and leave it. But of course, as earlier speakers have emphasized, to ensure effective exploitation of new discoveries, these research institutions must be complemented by organizations in the public or private sector, which can offer adequate manufacturing capability when it's needed. And that fortunate concatenation certainly proved its worth in this country in the recent pandemic. It's imperative, likewise, that nations should foster expertise in energy, climate, and the cybersphere, and that research and development should be accommodated in a range of institutions of complementary strength to facilitate blue sky speculation, long-term programs, and a rapid response to emergencies. Research isn't a zero-sum game, and indeed, as the last speaker emphasized, it's international. And it would be good for the UK, for instance, were there more top-tier research universities in the rest of Europe, incentivizing greater mobility and opportunity. Europe collectively could then offer a stronger counter-attraction to North America and to China as a destination for mobile talent. Sadly, this has had a serious setback due to Brexit, its reality, and even more its perception. And let's remember that in the so-called big sciences, there's long been well-managed European collaboration and European consortia have achieved real excellence. CERN in Geneva is destined to remain the world's leading lab for particle physics for at least the next decade. And Europe's space program, if we consider the scientific and unmanned part, is fully a match now for what NASA does. So those are exciting prospects. And I'd just like, before finishing, to turn from the academic end of research to the priorities. And of course, we know that the government has sets of grand challenges, 7, 6, or 4, depending on which report you read. But one of them clearly is going to be dealing with climate change. And for this, real breakthroughs are needed in energy generation, storage, and smart grids. And I think there's a broader and especially compelling motivation for prioritizing these efforts in countries like the UK and the US. And it's this: under business as usual scenarios, the main rise in annual CO2 emissions will come in the next 30 years from the countries in Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, which can't reach acceptable living standards without generating more power than they do today, more per capita, and their populations growing and will be 4 billion by mid-century. So bending the trajectory of CO2 emissions from these nations is crucial, because if they develop like China, they'll emit 40% as much CO2 as the whole world does today by 2050. The global South must be economically and technically enabled to leapfrog to clean energy rather than building coal-fired power stations. rather as they've transitioned directly to smartphones without ever building landline. So traditionally, technically advanced countries like ours can catalyze a far greater reduction in global emissions by helping the developing world to do its leapfrogging than we can just by achieving net zero ourselves. Remember that in this country, we are only 1 or 2% of global emission. And incidentally, similar arguments to those I've applied to climate change apply to the challenge of providing the world's food without encroaching on the natural environment and also easing the blight of infectious diseases. So those would be my priorities for long-term grand challenges because of their economic value and because it's hard to think of a more idealistic challenge for attracting young people into engineering than solving these great global problems. Thank you very much.